Today's program has been brought to you by Fairway Market, like no other market, a New York City institution that sells the best local, national, and international artisan foods for prices that can't be beat. For more information, visit fairwaymarket.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Greenhorns, this is Greenhorns Radio. I'm your host, Severin. I'm coming to you today from the Berkshires in Massachusetts, and I'm joined by Duke, who is not a farmer but a rancher out west. Hi, Duke.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. How is it going over there?
Yeah, it's doing well. It's cooling off for fall finally, which is welcome.
Yeah, it's starting to feel very, very twinkly and brisk over here.
Yeah, I can imagine. A bit more humid than we are here.
So tell us a little bit about what your season's been like or what's been going on with the beef world, just to get us caught up on it being October, and then we'll hear a little bit about your story in ranching.
All right. Well, things here have been pretty good, actually. We're hopefully on the tail end of about an 8-year, pretty extreme drought. It's been pretty tough. We only saw about an inch of total precipitation for the whole year of 2012. This year was looking to be the same, but it didn't grow like it normally would because of the severe past years. But we hit the bottom end of our average so far, and we've grown a bit of grass, but we're running at about half capacity to a third capacity. We've destocked to hopefully save the ground and set ourselves up when it does start raining, but it's been a pretty good year here so far. The market's holding up really well, and projections see it rising further, which would be awesome.
So people talk a lot about the price of beef being pretty stable because there was this drought has caused such a drastic destocking in the West that the supply of beef is very low. But can you explain a little bit about destocking and maybe a little bit about, from a holistic management perspective, what are your goals in managing and how do you make those decisions for your grasslands?
Yep. Well, we view the land as a multi-dimensional resource. So when the drought happens, we're not the only ones affected. It's the wildlife and people downstream, and it's a really big problem. So by destocking, we are taking a financial hit in our operations. It might mean we can't keep as many people on, or we can't run the same amount of equipment that we've run in the past. We'll rely more on horses, pulling a team to fix fence or put out mineral, haul hay or anything like that. But in the long run, it'll pay off because our ground is not being used as if it were receiving the normal amount of rain. And it reflects that once you do, and hopefully one day finally get rain. So we're big believers in that. And as I said earlier, we manage with animals, the wildlife in mind too, not just from a hunting standpoint, but just as a whole ecosystem, trying to keep an eye out for it. We are stewards of the land, and we feel responsible for it.
So I have now quite a number of friends who are new cowboys or new ranchers, have come from city or farm backgrounds, getting out on the range in their, you know, mid-20s. You had the good fortune to grow up on a family ranch. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I'm fourth generation rancher. My family, my great-grandfather, my grandfather started out in Texas. Then my grandfather moved to Venezuela, where he ran a ranch for the Rockefeller family. My dad was born there and only there for about 3 years or so, and then they moved to a ranch south of San Angelo, Texas, in Old Mexico, about 5 hours drive south of the border, where he ran a ranch with a partner in Texas. And that's where my dad grew up, and I've never been down to that place. But they sold that place when my dad was about 25 or so. And since then, my dad's kind of been bouncing around for the, since about 1999. And then in 99, we acquired this lease. He had to go through a formal or a proposal process, and he won out over agencies like the Nature Conservancy and other local ranchers to get this property. And it's not a family ranch. It's owned by the state of Colorado. It's just shy of 90,000 acres, and we have it on a 25-year lease. And then in 2004, we acquired another ranch in southern Colorado, and that ranch runs a wild herd of bison and, as well as some cattle, and that is owned by the Nature Conservancy, and we have that on a 20-year lease as well. So while we don't own any family land per se, I feel very fortunate to have grown up in a ranching family, with ranching being the tradition.
Well, and I mean, two generations ago in the Texas, well, now maybe I'm getting my timeline wrong, but isn't that the time of the Longhorn and like the beginning of driving cattle to markets further away?
That would predate it a bit. That might be on the very tail end of it. But no, we weren't really a part of any of that, unfortunately.
That sounds fun. That's like serious old school.
Yeah.
Feral cattle.
Yeah. Yep.
Okay, sorry. I get stuck in the fairy tale part. So you guys are running significant operations, two large ranch operations, and you're stocking them, and so you're just doing stocker cattle, or you're doing mothers and babies too?
Yeah, we're mostly cow-calf. We will hold some yearlings over, or depending on our grass, if we have a really good spring and summer, we'll bring on some yearlings, some stockers, but primarily cow-calf. And then the bison, that herd's run pretty feral. They run on 50,000 acres, and we just cull off whatever animal is to sale to keep the balance in the herd where we want it.
And the bison, I don't know hardly anything about bison, and I don't think very many other people do either. Could you tell us how bison are different in terms of their gut, in terms of their in terms of their impact, and in terms of their like habits of mind from cattle?
Yeah, I think bison are still a pretty new thing on the market, so people are all just trying to figure it out. And it's new to us. In 2004, we hadn't done anything with bison, and then we moved on to that ranch, and they're already there, so we acquired them. That herd is different than the cattle because it's kind of a hands-off approach to management. The Nature Conservancy wanted to try to make that scenario as possible, meaning there's no interior fencing, there's no prescribed grazing, just letting the bison free range over 50,000 acres and kind of watch them and see how they work. But bison, like cattle, will overgraze if given the opportunity or if forced into something like that. So they're on 50,000 acres, and that's a big property. But when you put that in the perspective of how things used to be, they used to have the entire western United States to roam. So they might hammer one spot and not come back for 5 years. So that would fully regrow. Whereas 50,000 acres, they'll hammer one spot. Correct. That face value, 50,000 acres seems big, but it's a drop of water compared to what it used to be.
Well, a drop of water would probably be useful just about now. The question I had was, do you ever try and move them? Like, even if you don't have fences to move them, just kind of, like a herder, herding people have moved animals all over the world just with horses or on horseback or on foot.
Right. We haven't tried anything like that. Our approach to managing them is just to keep the numbers as far down as possible. Something like herding them might work, but it would be incredibly labor intensive, especially at initially, because you would have to train the buffalo to horseback. They only get human contact once a year, so because of that, they tend to be pretty unpredictable and wild, essentially. It's like going to try to move a herd of elk on horseback or something like that. They see horses and people, and they're just not really sure what to do, so first instincts panic, run away. So that's not to say you could get them over that, because I completely believe you could, but it would take a lot of time up front, and unfortunately, at the moment, we don't have time to commit to that. So, like I said, we just try to manage them by keeping their numbers relatively low for that 50,000-acre pasture.
Interesting. I'm fascinated to know how that goes and where it goes, and you know, if it be like just bringing them salt and like showing them humans a bunch and being out there and rolling around and getting them calm.
Right. Anyway, one of our projects this fall, we're going to be sorting off between 200 and 400 heifer calves. They'd be weaner calves up to yearlings. And we'll actually be putting them in the corral that we work our normal cow herd on. And this is going to be one of the projects I'm focusing on, and actually gentling them down and trying to teach them to interact with humans and horses to the same extent that our cattle herds do. So it's just natural, so that hopefully we'll run them like a herd of cattle. Put them in a pasture for a certain amount of time, whatever we've determined, and then go out on horseback just like a cow herd and move them slowly without them breaking out and panicking, trashing fences and escaping. So we have experimented in the past, and I'm really looking forward to doing that. That'll be in the middle of October that we do that, or middle of November, sorry.
Yeah, it seems like that's a really... I came across a study that they did at Rutgers University in the 80s called the Buffalo Commons.
Mm-hmm.
Where, did you hear about that?
No, ma'am.
Well, it's kind of interesting. Basically, they looked at the land of basically the Ogallala Aquifer area, Texas and Panhandle area, and they basically said that the installation of irrigated agriculture and all the development of cotton and everything that had gone on, and corn, and that all of that animal agriculture, all of that agriculture really had, you know, a very negative energy and water impact on the landscape, and that over the long term, the most profitable thing to do would be deinstall agriculture and reinstall buffaloes over a pretty vast area.
Right.
And it was from an economic perspective that they were making that point. It was it's a pretty radical point to come out of a little, you know, Rutgers, but
I believe it, and it all has to be managed correctly, but you can do pretty amazing things with livestock.
So as a fourth generation rancher, and you're looking at the next kind of four generations out, where do you see ranch lands playing in? What are the kind of meta trends that your business is going to have to adapt to? What do you think is going to happen for kind of for grazers in this country?
Right now, if you're purely agriculture based, chances are you don't have the finances to go out and buy property. One of the only ways to make money in agriculture, substantial money to keep growing, is with making a bigger operation, diversifying extensively, or having a larger operation, and that's kind of what we're trying to focus in on. We are incredibly diversified as a business. We run a guest program, so we have a guest lodge on one property, and then a guest program, just two bedrooms on this ranch. But that invites people from the city to come out And one of them is more like a dude ranch. One of them is a working ranch experience where they come out and work with us and be a part of our team for a week, 2 weeks, or a month, however long they want to stay. We have full hunting programs on both properties. We have small farming operations on both properties. We have, obviously, the cattle and bison herds. And then on this ranch, we host concerts, conferences, try to bring people out to the ranch, try to show them the world out here, because, it's obvious the majority of people live in towns and civilization, and we are the minority out here, and we try to invite people out to give them a glimpse into this world out here that is relatively unknown besides what you see in movies and see in the news. So try to spread the word that we are out here, and we're not, we don't have a closed gate policy. We'd like as many people as wanted to come out and share our experience and see what's out here, so that we believe that spreading the word and opening people's eyes to the world out here is incredibly important. And going back to the earlier point, another business that we've started is called Ranchlands, and that is we're trying to put together properties, large scale properties, to diversify our business as well. We do extensive monitoring of all of our land, so I guess moving our view of land being a multidimensional resource onto other properties and developing our business at the same time conserving the land that we're managing, and improving it hopefully through our practices.
And so so what I'm hearing is you're feeling confidence in the future of beef and the future of rangeland management, and you feel,
yeah,
like there's even the possibility to get more stakeholders involved.
Yeah, we'd like to.
Yeah, well, it brings up the question of how does that translate into opportunity for, you know, people who want to be ranchers but who don't have that kind of capital to get involved. You know, I was thinking about soil carbon monitoring and how you can look at health of a piece of land and see, you know, what is the stocking rate, what is the ecology, what is the soil health, what's the organic matter, and then put a premium on improvement so that a young rancher who comes in with no capital onto these kinds of big ranches that are very expensive could, by improving the health of the land, you know, grow themselves some equity, a little nest egg that they could then leverage in getting their own business started, or, you know, sending their kids to college, or in other ways becoming a middle-class human being.
Right.
That, like, trying to match up the incentives of the land manager with the increasingly non-farming financial partners that are coming to dominate, like, ownership of these properties.
Yeah, and that's the difficult thing. It's not an easy thing to break into by any means. It's hard, and there's not a lot of money in it, and it's long, and you really have to be passionate about it, and really have to be fully invested. It's not just a job like a 9-to-5. It's a lifestyle. You have to be fully committed to do it. One thing that we have implemented on our ranch is to try to promote new people coming into, inviting them into our industry. We have an internship that invites people 3 months to come out and just get a feel kind of for what we do. It's a non-standard internship at all. But they come out and they really get their hands dirty and kind of see if it is something they want to get into. Because a lot of people will come out with all the best intentions and a burning passion for it, and then take sense for a few days and just swear it off, not want anything to do with it. And that's completely understandable. So I think it's a better way to break into it than throwing everything away and moving out west to become a cowboy, and then all of a sudden you don't like it anymore. Another thing we offer, and it's to a smaller group of people, it's pretty specific, is an apprenticeship, and that's a 2-year program, and we have three people going through it right now, and not one of them is from an agriculture background, And two of them are 2 years in, and the other guy's a year in, and that's more in depth. Most all of them come as an intern first, and see how they like it and see how everyone matches up, and then sign on for a 2 year minimum commitment. And we take them through, we give them part of the ranch to look after, they're responsible for everything on that part of the ranch, the water, the fencing, the roads. And then when the cattle are in that pasture, they're responsible for the cattle, the health, the water, everything that goes along with that. When they're moving, all the transects, photo points, everything that we put in. So it's a small thing because we cannot turn out large numbers of kids or young adults into the world that we've groomed, but it's kind of our small attempt at trying to give those people a hand breaking into it. And our hopes is that if our business Ranchlands is able to procure more properties, then we will have a place to put these people that we've trained into one of those ranches, into a good scenario where they can, in fact, just like you said, start building their nest egg.
So tell me, if you were giving counsel to a young cowboy or aspiring cowboy, where would be some of the places you would have them start? One place I'm going to go in a couple weeks is to the Quivira Coalition Conference down in New Mexico.
Yeah.
I really like that community a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have other suggestions where people should go and start poking around or learning what to expect of a town in the working West?
Yeah, that's a good place to start. We will have some people down there as well. And that's something we go to every year. One of our apprentices actually came from they did the Quivira apprenticeship, and now she's here doing it with us. That's definitely a good place to start. And I don't know, the big thing, if you want to be a cowboy and work cattle, the most important thing is getting in a lot of cattle. And one of the only places to do that in the U.S. where you just get volumes, so you learn their mannerisms and their reactions to your stances and just generally how to work cattle, is in the feedlots. It's not a glamorous job at all, but you can go to a place where there are thousands and thousands of head, and you get a feel for it. That obviously I wouldn't be able to do that long term, and it's not something that I've done. What I did as an alternative, I spent the last year in Australia working on the cattle properties there. I worked for 10 months in a mustering camp on two different places and combined acreage between the two stations, 3.5 million acres, and combined they would have run about 110,000 head of cattle. So I think that getting in as many possible is hugely beneficial for someone who wants to be a cowboy. Now, someone who is looking for something a bit deeper than just the glamour of a cowboy, definitely places like the Quivira Coalition or programs like ours. I know there's a few other ones around similar to ours. I don't know them off the top of my head. But yeah, anywhere you can get your foot in the door, because the agriculture community is very open and surprisingly interconnected. So something that might seem menial, a job fixing fence or building a barn, can definitely turn into more. You meet neighbors, those neighbors have relatives, and those relatives have friends all over the West, all over the U.S., all over the world. So just get your foot in the door at any level can lead to something. Maybe not, but a lot of the times it does.
Whoa, fun. That Australia experience sounds really awesome.
Yeah, it was incredible.
So you did Australia as a kind of a training experience. Did you have any other training experiences you went through?
That would be the big one. I have some more kind of looming on my horizon, but it's kind of hard to imagine a time when I'll be able to get to them. We have a good friend in San Angelo, Texas, who buys and sells a lot of cattle commercially. That's something I would like to go down and live with him for 6 months or so. And that would be the only other big thing. But a big part of it is getting out and trying a lot of different methods. So we might have a system that works really well for us, but maybe some personalities don't mix with it, or some landscapes obviously has to be changed. So spending time on a lot of places definitely helps. I've worked on quite a few places over the U.S., down in Mexico, and then now Australia. So just, yeah, trying to spread your horizons and take a little bit from every place you go.
Sounds pretty fun. I just wrote on my list, stint at a cattle ranch, investigate.
Yeah.
it sounds like a good retreat from activism to me. Well,
yes.
I appreciate your time very much and your work out on the land. I will maybe see you at Kivira. And if not, I just thank you for being on the show.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you very much, and sorry about the drop call.
No, don't worry. If people want to know more about Ranchlands Apprenticeship or the Kivira New Agrarians Program, you can check those out. Kivira Coalition is in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And Ranchlands, you guys are just ranchlands.org?
Ranchlands.com.
Ranchlands.com. All right. Thank
yep.
you very much.
Okay, thank you. Take care.
Bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.